Okay. Parshas Toldos Tavshin Samach Tes. Our objective today is to get a glimpse of a long, long historical journey that is not over yet. The complicated relationship between Yaakov and Esav, its origins, how it developed, how it expressed itself, and the future. We are at an interesting phase, interesting stage, you might say, in our relationship with Esav. Certainly the battle isn't over yet, but perhaps the worst is behind us, we hope. In any case, our job is to trace this journey that we took together, Yaakov and Esav, because inevitably we are linked together. We can't really go our separate ways. What we're going to do in viewing this long historical process is we're going to reread a few really popular psukim that you're all familiar with and hopefully get deeper understandings of them. Now, the main ideas that we'll be speaking about today come from both Rav Huttner in the Sefer on Purim, the last Mimer Lamed Hay, and also of Moshe Shapiro in the book Mimamakim, which actually wasn't written by him, but a student, but deals with this issue from a different angle. And all of this originates to some degree way before them and is found in writings of the great philosophers prior to them. All the way back to the Midrash. Now, the first interaction that we know Yaakov and Esav were engaged in was one of struggle. Competition, that will be the word that defines Yaakov and Esav, competition. So if you look in the beginning of Toldos, of course Rivka eventually becomes pregnant. By the way, just a point here. My daughter came home and told me that, isn't it crazy that Rivka got married at 3 years old? So I told her what my grandfather always taught me. These things are not necessarily to be taken literally. It says that Sarah died at the Akedah. We know that when Yitzchak married Rivka, it says, Vatihi Sarah Imo, she was Sarah's mother. Rashi comments on that pasuk. He brought her into the tent. Vayivyeha Oala Sarah Imo. Rashi says, Vaharehi Sarah Imo, she became Sarah's mother. So my grandfather always explained that at the time of the Akedah, she was at least a bas mitzvah. She was at least an adult. Then after the Akedah, Eliezer went to find her. And at the Akedah, when Sarah died, she received the neshama of Sarah. It was 3 years after the Akedah that Yitzchak married Rivka. He was 40. At the Akedah, he was 37. So it was 3 years since she was alive, with the neshama of Sarah. So really, she was probably 15. But 3 years in her new role as Sarah Imenu. And when he brought her into Sarah's tent, he saw this was Sarah. So we don't necessarily have to rely on the literal and almost the most difficult, approach, which sounds kind of unrealistic. There are other ways to see it. In any case, she finally becomes pregnant, and v'yisrotutu habanim bekirba, and they were fighting and quarreling and agitating within her. And she understood this was beyond the norm, and she went to ask from Hashem, which is from the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Ever. And he answered her, and he said, this is the prophecy, this is what you need to know, and this is Nevuah, what he told her. He said, Shnei Goyim Bebitnech, there are two nations right now at the same time inside of you. Two powers, two national forces will come out of you. Shnei Le'umim Mime'ayach Yiparedu, and two distinct peoples, two totally distinct peoples, will separate from already within you. It means not just at the time of birth will they go their separate ways, but Mime'ayach, from the moment that they're already just developing inside of you, they're already moving in totally different directions. And so she understood that there were two totally different kochos inside of her, and they would be separated and different from each other to a great extreme, that they really weren't compatible. However, when Rashi says here, trying to describe to us what they were fighting about on Vayisrotutu, he brings down that what they were fighting is they were fighting about the two worlds. Al-Nachala Shnei Olamos. They were fighting about the two worlds. Which two worlds? We know which two worlds. The problem is this. If one wants Olam Haba and one wants Olam Hazeh, what's the fight? There isn't a battle. The problem is that they both wanted both. Both of these children had different, had huge desire and saw the importance of both worlds and were driven to accomplish, to conquer, to dominate in both worlds. However, what she's being told is they're going to go to it in completely different ways. So first of all, we see that the difference between them is prior to them emerging into this world as individual children and prior to their parents' influence on them and prior to their education and prior to any interaction they had with each other. They were different at the core. But their interests were in essence similar in terms of the final goal. They were going to get to the final goal in two different ways. Later, this difference exhibits itself when Yaakov asks to buy the Bechora from Esav, and Esav willingly gives it up. And without going into that whole episode, you know that he says, Hinei Anochi Olech Lamus, I'm just going to die. There's too much responsibility and too much restrictions in terms of the spiritual and the religious. That's not how I live. It's going to kill me. I can't adapt to that. You take it. And he sold it for not $1 billion. He sold it for a bowl of soup. And if he really, really valued the Bechorah, he could have said, keep your soup, I'll go eat an apple. He sold it because that path was of no interest to him at all. Zero. That wasn't the path. But he still was never willing to admit that he had relinquished his right to both Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. He still didn't admit that because he gave up all the responsibility and living the life of action for Olam Haba, of all the mitzvahs that Yaakov took from him, then and all the responsibility of mitzvahs, he wasn't willing to admit that therefore he really abdicated his right to Olam Haba, to being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You see later on in the Parsha, in Perek Chaf Zayin, when Rivka interferes, Pasuk Chaf Gimel on page 136. Rivka interferes at the time of the brachas, and here she changes in the end the entire destiny of the Jewish people, and she insists that Yaakov go in there and take the bracha. We'll talk about the bracha in a second, because even though Esav doesn't admit that he's abdicated, he has. And he has no right anymore, and he can't be trusted at all with the role of the spiritual heir of Yitzchak. So what happens here is, the bracha that Yitzchak is about to give Esav, as you know, is not here at this point, Berchas Avraham. Berchas Avraham is Zera ve'eretz, Lezarecha eten es ha'aretz hazos. It's the spiritual legacy passed down from Avraham. That isn't the bracha that he was about to give Esav. He was about to give Esav a whole different bracha, and that's the bracha Rivka insisted had to go to Yaakov. Now, in order to understand this, first we have to see how Yitzchak himself expresses the difference between Yaakov and Esav, and then willingly gives that bracha because we know he knew that it wasn't Esav in front of him. It's clear from all the hints. When he realizes and then gives Esav's bracha to Yaakov and then later gives Yaakov Berchas Avraham over and above the bracha he gave Esav, it's the famous pasuk Chaf Gimel Hakol Kol Yaakov VaYadayim Yaday Esav. That's where he expresses the essential difference between them and then goes ahead and gives Yaakov the bracha. And the bracha, as you see, and we will go back to all of this, is a bracha for material domination and success. Nothing to do with spiritual. If you look in the next pasuk, in the next page, V'yitein lecha ha'elokim mital ha'shamayim u'mishmanei ha'aretz, the fat of the land, the dew of heaven, rov, dagan, v'tirash, and all kinds of produce of wheat and of wine, other nations will serve you. You will be a dominant force and a master of your brother. The children of your mother will bow to you. This is a bracha for domination of the material, physical world. That's what he was about to give Esav. He never intended to give Esav a spiritual bracha. How does this end up? Esav is very upset that Yaakov got his bracha, because Lezarecha eten es ha'aretz hazos, Avram's legacy to inherit Canaan, and the children of Avram inheriting this land and being kori b'shem Hashem in this land, as Avraham did, calling out in the name of Hashem, wouldn't have bothered Esav a bit that Yaakov got that bracha. He already gave that up. Yaakov took Esav's bracha. How did this end up? This ended up that they developed into a nation. Esav became, of course, the crystallization of Esav in its worst form as Amalek. And when the Jewish people leave Mitzrayim and they're in a desert, the first to attack them is Amalek. Right? Now we'll go back into that also. And of course, the only way they prevailed over Amalek, as we know, this Moshe lifting up his hands, and when he lifted up his hands, they were strong, and when his hands were weaker, and he lowered them, they became weaker also, the Jewish people, and that's, they prevailed by Moshe holding his hands up. And we won that battle with Esav, but there were many to follow, and they still bother us, and they still, many believe that the Second World War was Esav rising up again, Amalek rising up again, and we are told, when Moshe fights there in the end of Parshas, in Shemos Yud Zayin, just flip to here, the last pasuk in Parak Yud Zayin, page 392 in Bishalach, Hashem tells us Ki Yad Al Keska. There's a hand on the throne of Hashem. The throne, Hashem's throne of glory, will never be complete in a sense. Milchama la Hashem ba Amalek midor dar. There will be an eternal fight between Hashem and Amalek until the end. So that's really a glimpse, a tiny little overview of the history of Yaakov and Esav. What we have to now do is take one step deeper into it and begin to understand the essential difference between them. Yitzchak encapsulated. He said, "Akol kol Yaakov, Yadayim de Esav." What is kol and what is Yadayim? That's really the question. So Yadayim is always, this Rav Moshe Shapiro talks about, Yadayim is always an expression of maaseh, action, deeds, what you can build. You take your thoughts and your dreams and your imagination, and then you concretize it through your hands. So your hands are always symbolic of action, of creating of something material, physical. You need your hands to work with material things. You need your mind to work with abstract thoughts and ideas and memories and imagination and hopes and yearnings and understanding concepts. But your hands concretize that which your mind thinks of and your mind drives you towards as a goal. So, Esav is the one who owns the hands. The hands are Esav's. And Yaakov's is the mind, the intellect. Now, when we speak about the intellect, we're speaking about machshava, thoughts. We know that between the hands and the thoughts, the more divine, the more spiritual is clearly the thoughts. The only place we connect to God, really, through is our mind. Our mind is what ultimately connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The seat of the neshama is in the seichel, is in our thoughts. Our mind controls our heart. It should, anyway. Our mind should control what emotions we let ourselves feel and not feel. Tells us certain emotions are off limits, certain desires are off limits, certain impulses that we want, that we have passion to act after, are off limit. That's our mind tells us that. So the mind takes precedent over everything. And the mind is unlimited. It can think of thoughts that took place thousands of years ago or never happened yet. The mind is not bound by time, as we've spoken about by Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the concept of memory, which in a sense remembers the past and also is very linked to imagining the future. The mind, the ratzon of a person, can erase an avera that happened in the real material world just by wanting that avera to be gone, just by having regret. The mind can undo an action. The mind is where we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The mind is where the ideas of truth and what's right and good come down from the upper spheres into our head. We have a Torah that's a gift, teaches us, we learn it, and then we can express those things in action. But we only express in action what our mind feels and knows. So the mind is clearly the more elevated, the more spiritual, mystical, no question about it. However, you need the hands to build things. You need the hands to express those ideas in the material world. Yaakov was Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He was meant to be the thinker, the scholar, the idea man. He wasn't meant to have to implement. Esav was expected to implement in this world the ideas of Yaakov, and he would be excellent at that. That was his role. You see, although they were totally different, they were meant, as you know, to be partners, to work together. They weren't meant to be enemies. They had totally different ways of addressing the world, completely different, but they were meant to be together as a team. However, the ideas, the kol, which always represents the voice, represents a prayer, which helps us to elevate the material and guides it and directs it into the right spheres, and Torah learning. Torah learning is always called a kol because later on Moshe tells Klal Yisrael and Devarim, remember what you experienced at Sinai. You saw no picture. You didn't even really hear words, explicit words. You heard a kol. And that kol, and we've spoken about this too, that sound that you heard, which isn't a material, physical sound, because it came from Hashem, who's not material, that sound enlightened you with basic, absolute, concrete awarenesses. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Lo Yelech Elohim Acherim. That sound that you somehow understood to be all the truths that were later expressed in words in the Aseres HaDibros by Moshe, when he spoke to them. When we say they heard the first two Dibros, doesn't necessarily mean they heard the words. But Rambam talks about this in the Mor Nevuchim. But they heard a voice that was so obviously the same thing as Anochi Hashem Elokecha Lo Yelecha, the absolute presence of Hashem, the concept of Ein Od Milvado, there's nothing but Hashem. That's the essence of Torah. So Kol represents Torah. That's really our experience at Har Sinai, was Kol, was some type of permeating sound that told us Ein Od Milvado. And Moshe then said to them, you know what you just heard? I'll tell it to you in words. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, etc., etc. So Kol is Torah learning. That's Yaakov. And Ye Esav is Yadayim. It was Rivka who changed the course of history and decided that Yaakov can't be allowed to just be the scholar, the hermit on the hill, the man who lives in the world of ideas, the thinker. He is going to have to also be the implementer. He's also going to have to take hold of every material thing in this world and elevate it and use it correctly and channel it from the smallest object. Remember, he went back for pachim ketanim, for little jars, because they were earned with honest labor, so they were kadosh. But to nation building, to inside, to creation of an entire country, commonwealth, a national existence with national institutions, and all that goes into building a nation, economics and finance and all politics, everything that goes into a nation, all of this has to be implemented and expressed by Yaakov too. He no longer can be spared all of that. He has to get into that world too. Why? Because Esav can't be trusted. Esav already demonstrated that he had no interest in channeling and using his ability to dominate this world for Yaakov's, according to Yaakov's guidance. So Rivka insisted that Yaakov has to take over Esav's role. In other words, from this point on, Yaakov became Hakol Kol Yaakov and Hayadayim Yaday Esav. Yaakov needed to be the man who would be responsible for both things. Now, once this responsibility was, in a sense, he had given up the Bechorah. He said, I don't want the material expression of these philosophical concepts. I don't want to do the mitzvahs. Period. The mitzvahs are also the masim, the deeds.
So Esther, how is it that only Rivka
Well, Rivka had the nevuah. Rivka, this is a very good point. Rivka received the nevuah from Beis Medrash of Shem Bey, remember? By the way, this is a very important point, and it's a tiny bit of a tangent. Remember when Moshe said to Hashem, "Behem lo yaminu bi," when I go to them and speak in your name, the Jews are not going to believe me? And everybody thinks Moshe was like doubting the trust of the Jews. No, this is Moshe's not doing anything wrong here. Up until Moshe Rabbeinu, if you think about it, although various of our avos nimos received nevuah at certain times, never was a nevuah given before Moshe Rabbeinu that was meant for other people. In other words, if somebody received a nevuah, it was for them and them alone, and they had no right to transmit it or pass it on. Never before did Hashem say to a Navi, like here by Rivka, "This is what I'm telling you, and go tell so-and-so." Until you get to Vidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemar, Daber el B'nei Yisrael, it never happened. So Moshe said, "Why will they believe me? I'm coming to speak in your name. Lo haya v'lo nivra." Never was like that. No one ever spoke to someone else, to a third party, on behalf of you, Hashem. If you want to speak, speak to them directly. Why would they believe me? He was right, and they were right. They really didn't have to believe him, because Hashem only spoke directly to the prophet, and the prophecy was for their ears only. That is a fundamental rule. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai, remember, he said, "You come up here on the mountain," and then it says, "V'yishma ha'am bedabre imach," and the nation will hear me speak to you, "V'gam b'cha yaminu l'olam," and then they're going to trust you. Because why should they trust you if you're speaking in my name and they haven't heard me speak? Why would they trust you? Maybe you're just a big tzaddik, but who says you're speaking in my name? So Hashem allowed Klal Yisrael to hear Hashem speak to Moshe, and then they trusted Moshe. Now here too, the real answer to this is she was told this nevuah, and there's no indication that she was allowed to repeat it further.
Can it be not her own husband?
Yeah, she can't repeat it further. It has nothing to do with it. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can tell Avraham, for example, Shema Bakola, listen to her, because she has, Rashi says, more nevuah than you, and she knows what she's talking about. So Hashem instructed Avram to listen to Sarah's nevuah. But Sarah couldn't compel that. And here she seems to be not permitted to repeat this. Never, there's no indication, no example of a prophecy that was allowed to be repeated until Moshe Rabbeinu. In any case, Rivka, only because Yitzchak was no fool, and he saw Esav's behavior, and he saw Yaakov's behavior, and he smelled Yaakov, and he understood this whole thing. He understood that Rivka, or Yaakov, had felt that it was dire that this bracha not go to Esav. Now, why Yitzchak wanted to give the bracha to Esav is because it was completely compatible with Esav's personality. In fact, later the bracha he does give to Esav, by the way, is a similar bracha, but not quite, and we're not going to go into the analysis of it, but he says to Yaakov, to Esav, the following. Here. "V'yan Yitzchak aviv v'yomer lav, hinei mishmanei ha'aretz yiyeh moshavecha," from the fat of the land will be your dwelling place. Rashi says there, what country is this? Italia. This is Italy. As we know, our tradition is that Esav is Rome, Edom. That's our tradition. Rashi talks about this as Italy. Rashi is 1,000 years ago. Anyone who's been to Italy knows that true, this bracha has rightfully, you know, fallen upon this land. The land is blessed, one of the most gorgeous lands on earth. And so he does give Esav some type of a bracha, but we're not getting into all those details now. But Rivka understood that the ability to utilize and dominate and have this world in his hands would have to be Yaakov's role, because Esav himself said, "I don't want the masim. I don't want to elevate everything material and make everything into a mitzvah and use it for the right reasons." In other words, when we speak about the masim now, the hands now in Yaakov's arena, what we mean is the bitul, the negation of all things material and physical. Their negation in terms of enjoying them for themselves, and the demand that they be used and elevated strictly for Kiddush Hashem, for Shem Shemayim. That nothing, we really are saying that a Jew now, Yaakov's role now is to take everything in this world and elevate it, and therefore if we don't elevate it and we just indulge in it for itself, by itself, that's already what Esav wanted. That was already Esav's approach, to be able to enjoy, to completely, you know, be completely enveloped by and indulge in everything material, not to elevate it for spiritual, and at the same time demand that they have Olam Haba too. How's that? We'll see. So Rivka interferes here and insists that it becomes Yaakov's. What happens? Yaakov doesn't want to, but he is compelled. And he's compelled to take on Esav's role. Later on, he wants to marry Rachel. And again, he's forced, tricked by Rachel, to marry Leah. There's something a lot more going on there than just arvos, just responsibility one for the other in a sense. It's much greater, much deeper. Leah, the Bali Machshav explained to us, represents and is meant to be really Esav's mate. She shares the kochos of Esav. She was the one that was able to bring the kochos of Esav into Klal Yisrael in the positive way, what Esav himself should have done. She was the fitting mate. Esav, though, veered off. And so Yaakov, Rachel realizes, must take Leah and must incorporate the kochos of Leah, which are similar to Esav, into Klal Yisrael. Now, how does this happen? Watch this. She names her first child Reuven. And Rashi says, Reu, look, what the difference is between me and my husband's brother. That Esav took from the Gezel, but my son with the Dudayim took from the Hefker. He didn't steal it, he took from what was open and available, no man's land when he brought the Dudayim. So she already said, he's Esav in a positive way. Then she had Shimon and Levi, they live by the sword, that's Esav's tool, al harbacha tichya. They use it in the end for good. They have the koach of Esav. Yaakov was very angry about the Shechem incident, but they're meant to, like Levi did later, it was a harsh episode by the Egil. They're meant to take that koach of domination and control, the sword, and use it correctly. Then she gets Yehuda. Who's Yehuda's most important grandchild? David. David is called Admoni, all red, just like Esav. There are many indications, but he's Yafe Einayim, with beautiful eyes, and that means that he listened to the Sanhedrin, the eyes of the nation. So each of them had kochos from Esav, and yet they were incorporated into Klal Yisrael and used correctly. Now, where is the final statement that Esav and Yaakov have all their talents unified as one and will work together? Leah stops having children, remember? And the Tamon Mileda, she stops having children. She was successful in incorporating the kochos of Esav. But then there's that whole episode with the Dudaim. And there with the Dudaim, Rachel, in a sense, acquiesces. And she gives Leah permission, fully, to be with Yaakov. And who is the product of this? Yisachar and Zebulun, that is Yaakov and Esav. Yisachar and Zebulun are what Yaakov and Esav should have been, and the product of Leah and Yaakov in finally reaching its proper stage, finally reaching perfection. However, although we've incorporated both the kochos of Esav and the kochos of Yaakov into our one nation, which is not an easy task, Esav refuses to abdicate. And he's always, in the form of Amalek, looking for the weakness. What will be the weakness? Where he will demand back his Yodayim. Where he will demand back domination of this world and not let it go to Yaakov. Where is there evidence of weakness? Wherever the Klal Yisrael starts softening on the mitzvahs. Whenever Klal Yisrael stop making sure that every part of the material world that they take for their own is elevated and not just indulged in for their own gratification. Esav or Amalek is always on the lookout. And as soon as we slack off, they come to claim back their rightful heritage that was only given to us, or rather that we took from them because they didn't deserve it. But if we're in the same position as them and we're approaching the world of masa, of material, of action, the same way they do, we have no greater claim than they do. and they want it back. So where is the first place Amalek attacks? Turn to page 390, actually 388, in Beshalach, on their way out of Mitzrayim. On their way out of Mitzrayim, Amalek comes and attacks them. But the words that introduce this story is V'yusu kol adas b'nei Yisrael mi'midbar sin l'ma'aseihem al pi Hashem v'yachanu b'refidim v'ein mayim l'shtot ha'am. This is before Har Sinai. Here comes Amalek. There's some type of, as you see a few psukim later, v'yavo Amalek, psukim ches and tes. The Chazal want to know, what brought on Amalek? Here, wait a second, we talk about nations that hate the Jewish people. We haven't yet received the Torah. We have no land. We have no national identity yet. We aren't anybody. There's no politics to fight against. There's no economics to fight against. There's no national liberation movement. We don't have someone else's territory. We're not controlling anybody. Nothing. Zero. All the reasons for anti-Semitism don't exist. None of the reasons that have been presented over the thousands of years exist yet. What is the core of their hatred? Why are they coming? So Medrash brings down here, refidim, and the word refidim, Rashi says here, bringing down from Tosha Bal Peh, of course. This all comes from, you know, from before those that actually reported to us. Refidim means rifyon yadayim meha Torah meha mitzvahs. A softening of the hands from Torah and mitzvahs. That's Vayavo Amalek. In other words, their core competition with us is whether we're doing our job, which is partly their job, that we've taken upon ourselves, correctly. That's what it's all about. It has nothing to do with any external motives. How are we approaching the world of masa, of deeds, of material? Now, ideally, when we elevate everything physical, we are elevating and sanctifying the physical, starting with our own bodies. We say, Asher Kedishanu, you have made us Kodesh. Us personally, physically, we're Kodesh. That's why a Jewish person has Kedushas Haguf. That's why when a Jewish person dies, their body is Tamei Meis, because when it was alive, there was Kedusha, and the void left, when there's no more life, is called tuma. But a non-Jew who has no kedushas haguf, because the material is not elevated, doesn't have tuma when they die. The body of a non-Jew is not tumei, because it never was kadosh. But the Jewish person's body has kedusha, and therefore the lack of it is called tuma. We have kedushas haguf by elevating the physical to a spiritual level. Now, when Amalek sees that there is some slacking in that, they have like a sixth sense. They know it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends them to us. When there's a rifyon, a softening of the hands, the yadayim. A rifyon yadayim. Esav is immediately sent in to attack, to take back. Say, well, then let it be ours. Then let the whole world be under our domination, and you don't have a right to it. You don't have a right to be stronger than us and more successful and flourishing more and living on a better land and having more money and having more, you know, more glory to show the world with the things you build and the things you have, and later on your national institutions and your buildings and your land. You have no right to it. How do we fight Amalek? Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yeshua went to fight. Moshe v'Aaron v'Chor alu rosh ha'giva. What's the next pasuk? V'haya kasher yarim Moshe yado. When Moshe lifted his hands, his yadayim, v'gavar Yisrael. That's when Klal Yisrael had gevura, had strength. V'kasher yaniach, but when his hands would rest, v'gavar Amalek. That's the whole thing. Amalek would be stronger. Moshe's hands being elevated here are symbolic. He's raising up the hands, the koach of the yadayim, of all of Klal Yisrael. It's a very difficult task because it's much harder to be a scholar and to sit and separate oneself and think sublime ideas. You have to have a certain temperament, a certain ability. You have to be trained. You have to remove yourself from the physical. It's a very difficult task. the natural thing for human beings is to be involved in the physical. And the natural thing is to use the physical for our own purposes. So to elevate the physical is tough. And the only way a person can be strong and constantly do that on a regular basis, if they're continuously being fed, drinking from, nursing from the strength of the Torah that's coming through the head, that's the only way to elevate the body. If a person doesn't learn Torah and doesn't know the ideas of Torah, it is going to be virtually impossible to elevate the body. Where will they find the strength? Where will they find the determination? Where will they find the impetus to elevate the body and to sanctify it, if not for the ideas in their heads that's pushing them? So Moshe understands that the whole path to the hands is through the head. So Moshe himself, who represents the kol, the greatest of all, he doesn't give this task to anyone else. He sends Yeshua to fight, but he goes up the mountain with Aaron, who else? And Hor. And they lift up their hands. And this lifting of the hands is the first image we have of prayer with elevated hands. This stance, this position was used first and solely really against Amalek, to weaken the hands of Amalek. In this case, we win. But Amalek has come back many times. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says here, Ki Yad Al Keska. Again, the hand of Amalek is what's keeping the throne of Hashem incomplete. Isn't that what that means? Is that Hashem's glory cannot really be known to humanity in this world, that Hashem's Shechina cannot really permeate this world as long as there's Amalek and the koach of Amalek that's taking this world and using all of it for our own self-interest, narcissistic purposes, not elevating it. That's called Amalek. That diminishes the awareness of Hashem in the world, obviously. That's called the hand of Amalek. Now, there are a number of letters missing from this pasuk. Kiyad, the hand, that's Amalek, Yadayim. Al kes, there's an aleph missing, right? Should be kise. And ka, what's missing here? A vav and a hey. An aleph, a vav, and a hey. The tikkun for this is in Tehillim. We talk about Tehillim kuf lamed beis yud zayin. Here's how it all ends. Ki bachar Hashem b'tzion. In the end, Hashem will choose tzion. Now look at the next word. Eva. What does that mean? Lemoshav lo. That will be his dwelling place. Eva alev vav hey. So remember my Shkira? That's the letters missing from this pasuk. Aleph vav hey. The letters missing from kiyad al kes ka. Kes is missing an aleph for kise. And yud ke vav ke is missing a vav and a hey. It's just ka, yud hey. So in the end, the aleph, the vav, and the hey will be restored. And in the end, Tzion will be the dwelling place of Hashem, as it should be. But in the meantime, it's not fully established as the dwelling place because of Amalek. This is what holds, or the koach of Amalek, that's holding us back. So here, Moshe's hands are incredibly important. And we're told that that hand, Ki Yad Al Keska, that's the battle we're always fighting. Everybody understands that when Klal Yisrael said Naaseh, just shortly after this, Naaseh v'nishma. What are we saying? Asiya, Esav, the mitzvahs, the physical, that we will do. We will take Esav's role and v'nishma, and we will hear the call. We'll play Yaakov's role. Naaseh v'nishma. They understood that. Esav's role and Yaakov's role. And this is our battle. Now what happens is something strange, something peculiar took place in history, and Chazal projected it. We're told that there will be a nation, or Futner talks about this, there will be a nation in the future. Here's Chazal say, Tzipa Kadosh Baruch Hu Shasidin Umas Olam. The Targum es HaTorah b'Yevanis, eventually the nations of the world will translate the Torah into Greece. V'lishlot bo, and to dominate it and claim it's theirs. V'lomar, and they will say, Anu Yisrael, we are Yisrael. Rav Hunter brings down Rabbi Akiva Eger, who asks a question, and this really is part of the answer, the concept of Anu Yisrael. He says, why do we no longer daven? Why don't we daven like this anymore? This was the position of Jewish prayer. whether it's like this or like this. We don't pray like that anymore, but we did. That was our position of prayer. And it started with Moshe by Amalek. And he answers that, how could something that was ahuv, so beloved to our ancestors, could be so disliked now by the grandchildren? How come we've rejected it? It was ours. It started with us. And so he explains that understanding who Esav is will help us understand this, why we've pushed this whole position away. We don't do it anymore. Because they've taken it over, so we automatically lose it. He says, what happens is the descendants of Esav, who we call Edom, we call Italy, we call Rome, we call Christianity, our major competitor for 2,000 years, they have decided, like their great-great-grandfather Esav, that despite the fact that they gave up on the mitzvahs and they rejected them and indulged entirely in this world, they still can claim to have the strongest attachment, and they deserve Olam Haba, and they are the key to spirituality in this world. In essence, Anu Yisrael, Yisrael is Yaakov's name. We are Yisrael. And to that end, they took our qualities that define us as Yaakov, as Yisrael. They took our Torah, and they took our position of prayer. That's Kol Yaakov, Torah and Tefillah. They took our position of prayer and started praying with like this, or however they pray. And they took really with the hands, and they took our Torah. They translated the Torah. And they said, Anu Yisrael, we are your firstborn child, Yisrael. We haven't relinquished our claim to that position. And so they have decided that they're us. Now, the question is, are they? Have they replaced us? It's quite striking, Rav Huttner points out, that Yaakov and Esav begin not as brothers, born separately at separate times. They begin as twins in the same womb at the same time. And he explains that when two trees look the same, the bark is similar, the branches spread out in a similar way, the leaves look the same, and you say these trees are absolutely different from each other. You can't tell from the physical. You have to look into the shorish, the core, perhaps the genetics. Maybe the fruit that it produces looks different, but everything else looks the same. It says when two things are the same, are twins, the concept of twins, that when two things are twin, perhaps even identical twins, and then you say they're these two brothers that are identical twins, they're nothing alike. You can't look at the external. You must look at the core, at the shoresh. It says Yaakov and Esav come into this world as twins, which teaches us that their difference is deep in the core, although they might look the same outside. Eventually, when the Christians put on yarmulkes and took our Torah and our Tehillim, everything but our Torah Shebal Peh, even that they tried to access, but they certainly took our Torah Shebichtav, they took all our writings, no question about it, reinterpreted them to suit their needs, dressed like us and prayed like us. They were not after Yadayim Yedei Esav, not that quality that we had. They were only after us, as our role as Kol Yaakov, saying that that's their role. They're Yisrael. I mean, you turn on the TV channel Sunday morning and you see the state, the gospel channels, and you see the televised church, services, and the guy gets up there, or the woman, and says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." They're talking to themselves when they call themselves Israel. Hear, O Israel. That's them. That's not us. They are Israel. Absolutely. They believe they are Israel and they have replaced us. And so Chazal said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that there would be a time that they would translate the Torah and say, we are Israel. And so Kachaya, so it was. They want Kol Yaakov, but they refuse to give up Yadayim Yedei Esav. They refuse to use the material and elevate it to the spiritual. The material they have and they use is all for their own self-indulgence, and unfortunately Christianity has a long history of the most corrupt and evil and vicious popes and leaders and church fathers. And all you have to do is go to Italy and go into the Vatican and go into the museums there. and go into some of the palaces and fortresses that they built that make the jewels and the luxuries of all the other kings on earth look stupid. In the Vatican, I was in the museums, there is a stone, I guess it's some form of marble, called Targumon. It's purple, it's exquisite. The church at some early point made a rule that no one is allowed to mine or dig or own this material except for them. They have depleted the entire world's source. There's no more of this material left. They've taken all of it. And it's on every floor and every pillar and in every room. Only for their glory. It hasn't been elevated. I saw some of the jewels, some of the crowns that the popes have worn through the ages and the scepters and all of that. It's beyond anything you can imagine. And with all of that, they were cruel, not just to the Jews. They were cruel to their own people. They were cruel. They plunged the world into the dark ages. People suffered tremendously under the rule of the church fathers. And all of this material wealth, what they did in essence, when I was in Rome, it became so obvious. What they did is they decided they were going to be the Roman emperors, but they're going to call it religious. And they lived just like the Roman emperors, and even to a greater degree. And they tortured everyone. And every church and every palace of the popes has the worst miserable dungeons you can imagine, where people suffered there. And much has been written about this. They certainly don't hold the place of our Chachamim and our Torah leaders through the ages. There's no comparison. And yet with all this, Anu Yisrael, we are Klal Yisrael. And they took everything that's spiritual in nature, prayer and Torah, and they've in a sense pretended it was theirs. So what happens? We say Anu Yisrael, and they say Anu Yisrael. We say we have a right to elevate and use, and we have rights to everything in this physical world to elevate it, and that's how we earn the next world. And they say we have rights to everything in this world, and it's ours, and we will accumulate all of it and indulge in all of it, and we still are Yisrael. And in the end, the future is ours. So on Yom Kippur, we take two Se'irim. A Se'ir is Esav. One is Lashem, and one is Lazazel, and they're both twins. And they look exactly alike, the same height, the same age, the same size. They have to be exactly identical. One is Lashem, we spoke about this, right? Mm-hmm. And one is Lazazel. The difference between us is at the core, not in the trappings. It's at the core. This is the battle that we are engaged in all the way till the end. Ki yad al keska. And the only way for us to legitimately have a right to this world, as we spoke about last week, kol, if everything's a kli, that's really an extension of that concept. If everything is a kli, we have a right to it, and it's ours, and Esav can't touch it. But if anything is not a kli, it's just a source of indulgence, narcissism, self-centered, pleasure, hedonism. Esav comes immediately and takes it back from us, demands it, because it really is theirs under those circumstances. The way we translate actions, the way we translate the material into elevated actions is through mitzvahs. Everything in the end becomes a mitzvah. What we say, what we eat, what we buy, what we build, everything in the end is translated into a mitzvah. And that mitzvah is our protection. And that's really the understanding from the Nesivos Olam. The Maharal explains, Ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. It's really action and knowledge. A mitzvah, actions, it's like a candle. And Torah, awareness, understanding, that's or. What's the difference between a candle and light? So imagine somebody lost in a forest in the pitch black. So give that person a lamp or a light or a torch, and they can protect themselves from themselves. In other words, they won't fall down a pit. They won't walk into a thorny bush. They won't, step on a dangerous snake. They can protect themselves from themselves. That's the mitzvah. A mitzvah protects a human being from the dangers that we ourselves will inevitably fall into. through our impulses and our passions and our desires, we will do things that will be harmful to us, both in this world and the next world. And if we, instead of those things, we do mitzvos, then we protect ourselves. But the mitzvah is temporary. It's associated with the body. And even a mitzvah without kavanah is certainly temporary. It's a shmirah. It's protective. It's helpful, but it's temporary. What has to be added to the mitzvah is the kavanah, the ideas, Torah, understanding of Torah, all kinds of learning in every area that increases our perspective and our appreciation and our closeness to Hashem. That's light. Only with the dawn of the day are the dangerous forces like the gang, the thieves, the bandits, the wild animals held off. In other words, the lamp cannot protect him from some thief, right, attacking him. It could just protect him from himself. Only daylight gives perspective, shows him the way, keeps off the dangerous forces, repels them. That's Torah ideas. That gives perspective. That keeps a person, you know, on track so that not everything is a huge battle. That's Torah knowledge. In the end, our job is both Torah and action and mitzvahs. In the case where there's a competition between an opportunity to learn Torah or to do a mitzvah, although Torah is greater, no question about it, and it helps us do the mitzvahs and it gives us strength to do the mitzvahs, when there's an opportunity either for Torah or mitzvahs, the rule is, if the mitzvah can be done by someone else, let it be done by someone else, and the person learns Torah. If it's the kind of mitzvah that can't be done by someone else, then a person has to do it. And those are many mitzvahs, for example, that men do, mitzvahs, aseh, shezman, guam, that have to be done by the person at a certain time. But if someone else can do a mitzvah, a person can learn. So in the end, it's the learning that informs the actions, and it's a unified whole. And so we're always on the lookout for anything that distracts us and that divides up the ideas from the behavior, that takes the behavior off on its own path, gives Esav back the koach hayadayim in a sense. And we're always involved with distinguishing between those that claim to be us, to look like us, that have taken our entire identity in a sense and our unique role. And we realize that, as we said in the beginning, that the worst, hopefully, is behind us, because the church no longer dominates the government. There's a separation of church and state. This is the great blessing of this country. And perhaps we're even seeing that the possibility, which Rashi speaks about, of the compatibility and the cooperation between Yaakov and Esav, because there was a moment in time in the height of the Roman Empire where Rebbe and Antoninus, Rebbe who compiled the Mishnah, and Antoninus who seems to be Marcus Aurelius, it's a philosopher king among one or two of the great Roman emperors, were actually chavrusas. They learned together. Antoninus was very inspired by Rebbe. Rebbe benefited from Antoninus. This is the perfect union of Esav and Yaakov. Now that they no longer have the ability politically to dominate us and to persecute us and to keep us repressed as they have for thousands of years as a way of proving that they were God's chosen and we were rejected, you do see that some of our Torah has permeated into the minds of the descendants of Esav, and they've used it not to work against us, but to help us. So, for example, we've spoken about this before too, this country is built by our founding fathers, and certainly the Adams family, by the way, John Adams, the second, and the John Quincy Adams, and Samuel Adams, they were all huge lovers of the Jews and of the Torah, and tried to build this country based on biblical values. They weren't the only ones. Also Jefferson and Washington. They took a huge step towards us in terms of learning from us, trying to build a country based on biblical values. By the way, I've mentioned this before also. Both Presidents Adams and Samuel Adams was a cousin. They have a great-great-grandchild in Lakewood, who's a frum Jew. His name is Adams. He's a Ger Tzedek. I would like to meet them one day, but I know people who know them. In any case, so in a sense, this whole country is built on an appreciation of who we are. In fact, this country, the most blessed country on earth, the richest country on earth, the strongest country on earth, the most influential country on earth. This is Esav in its best, you might say, who openly the founding fathers learned from us, tried to model their country after us and our laws and our morality and our equality and our decency and the rule of law. Everyone is equal under the law. They all took this from us, and they know their debt of gratitude is for the Jews. They were great lovers of the Jews. You know about the original language was even considered to be Hebrew. One of the original seals has HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name on it. This is the proper orientation of Esav to Yaakov. We've even seen glimpses of this. No one could have imagined this a couple hundred years ago, in the darkness of the Gullus, you know, and the darkness of the Middle Ages. But this is, we've actually seen this. And by the way, I'll end with this one idea, because it's late. It's a little bit of a tangent, but it's built off the concept we've been speaking about. Often, there's an argument, you know, do you have to be religious to be a good person? So, you might say to a secular Jew or a non-Jew who lives in America, who's influenced by the way we think in this country and our Constitution and our Declaration, that somebody might argue, no, absolutely not. You don't have to be religious to be a good person. I know so many good people who are not religious. So you say to them, really, you're not religious and you're a good person? Okay, prove it. Tell me 5 good things you do. Do you think you're so good and you're not religious? So here's the list every single time. I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't commit adultery, I give charity, I respect the elders, I respect the environment. So then you say to them, that does sound very good, but can you mention something that's not specifically listed in the Ten Commandments? In other words, our entire sense of morality as Americans is biblical. It's not automatic. It's because the founding fathers based the values of this country on Torah values. Judeo-Christian means Jewish. And so we don't even realize that what's considered a natural, decent person is Torah, that we are religious, they are religious. It's all influenced by religion, because if you went to India or China or Afghanistan, that would not be the list of what makes me a good person. What makes me a good person in Afghanistan or in a Muslim country or in an Indian country is the following, or in a caste system. I wouldn't say every Indian, but in the caste system, I don't feed the hungry. I don't heal the sick because I'm humble. I don't interfere with the gods. I kill the infidels. I cut off a hand for a hand. You know, that's the list. That's the list of what makes me a good person. This is strictly Jewish. So there's hope that the worst is behind us with the descendants of Esav. And yet at the same time, we are always aware that our job is, if we have Esav's power, not used correctly, we're always threatened by the reemergence of Esav. Okay, everyone.